Lewis, I think, wanted to be an atheist poet. He ended up being a Christian apologist. And I think that's a very powerful argument for the grace of God at work in the world.
I'm William O'Flaherty from EssentialCSLewis.com. And today on All About Jack and C.S. Lewis podcast, I'm sharing a very special interview I did with Dr. Alistair McGrath. It was recorded on March 20th, just hours before he spoke at Wheaton College to share about the new biography, C.S. Lewis, A Life. A former atheist, Dr. McGrath is now a priest ordained in the Church of England and professor of theology, ministry, and education at King's College, London. Formerly, he was professor of historical theology at Oxford University. While there are many biographies on Lewis, before I ask you the why did you write this one, let's first address the more general why someone should read about an author as opposed to reading their works firsthand.
Well, I think that's a very good question. And of course, indeed, Lewis himself tended to think of an author's works as being far more important than his life. Think of his preface to Paradise Lost. But I think on this point, Lewis needs supplementation. I think it does help to read about an author's life. I think it means that when you read their writings, you get far more out of it. For example, when you read Narnia, you realize what a difficult time Lewis was going through around the time that series began to emerge. So I think your reading of Lewis's writings is enriched by knowing more about his life, more about the people who influenced him, more about the intellectual culture of his day and age. So, okay, you can read Lewis without a biography, but a biography opens doors and brings new depth to your reading of Lewis.
I can relate to that, especially just recently here we had a missionary speak, and then at the men's breakfast, though, he gave his testimony, so the next day when I heard his sermon, it meant a lot more when I understood the challenges in his own life, and so I think that's very important. Now, let's get to that obvious. Some have said that your biography is the first one looking at all aspects of Lewis's life since the 1990s. Others may disagree with that assessment, but if that were to be true, it's been then about 20 years since a new biography. Was something like that alone your motivation to write a biography for a new generation of Lewis readers, especially considering it's the 50th anniversary of his death?
Well, I think the 50th anniversary of his death is very appropriate. That means, in effect, there's something about Lewis that means he's still being read. So the 50th anniversary, I think, is a very nice occasion in which to publish a biography. But I think what really struck me was this. There is a rising generation of people who know Lewis primarily through Narnia, whether it's the books or the movies. And I thought, wouldn't it be good to write a biography that, A, is very, very up-to-date with literature, but, B, engages a readership who know Lewis in a very specific way, who say, in effect, I want to know more about this guy, Lewis. Who is he? What else did he write? Where did Narnia come from? So really, this biography is primarily aimed at those who've heard about C.S. Lewis and thinking, this guy sounds really interesting. I want to know more.
Now, some may not be aware that you also have another book dealing with Lewis coming out. While our focus is obviously on the one published by Tyndale, C.S. Lewis, A Life, I mention it for you to comment on why that content didn't fit per se into this one. Of course, there's the obvious fact that your biography is just over 400 pages. Did you feel, though, that there was so much that you had to leave out or not write as much about? I'm also thinking about his relationship with Tolkien and Davidman especially, that you note that you kind of hold back some.
I think when I began to research this biography, I found there was so much material that I needed to include in the biography, and I just knew I couldn't find space for it all. And also, our biography tells a story. It doesn't do detailed conceptual analysis. And so I realized that I would need to write a second, much more academic book doing this conceptual analysis. So in effect, the biography includes the results of this, but not the fine detail. For that, you go to the Intellectual World of C.S. Lewis, which publishes next month.
Now, I made reference to Tolkien and his friendship. I want to maybe focus on the importance of this friendship and maybe friendships in general, like his brother, Warney, and then Charles Williams. In fact, it was this month that he first wrote to Charles Williams back in 1936. But could you address the idea that Lewis may not have been the person we know today without the influence of Tolkien? And in some regard, maybe Tolkien may not have been what he became without Lewis, as well as the general role of friendship in the life of Lewis.
Well, let's talk about friendship in general. In his Four Loves, Lewis makes it very, very clear that friendship is essential to human development. And there's no doubt that Lewis found his friendship with his brother, with Tolkien, with Charles Williams, and with others enormously important, not simply in sustaining him as a person and a writer, but also in stimulating him. I mean, in effect, writers would spark each other off, and the Inklings is a very good example of a community where, in effect, ideas are generated, critiqued, and improved. So I have no doubt that Lewis and Tolkien and others, in effect, wrote better books than they otherwise might have done because of the influence and encouragement of others. But of course, Tolkien does stand out. And one of the things that impressed me as I began to read Lewis in the 1920s is he talks about Tolkien. And although you and I look back and say, hey, this is the world-famous Lewis meeting the world-famous Tolkien, at the time, nobody had ever heard of either of them. We are in at the beginning of a very significant friendship when nobody knew it was really going to go places. And certainly you're right, these are very significant figures for each other. Lewis, in effect, was the midwife to the Lord of the Rings. Tolkien, in effect, led Lewis to Christianity, helped him to understand the importance of myth, and I would say opened the door to a new imaginative way of beginning to open up the divine for human beings. So I think there's a lot in that relationship. Sadly, as you know, it went wrong, and I think that that is something that I found very, very sad as I researched it. One of the few things I could contribute to this discussion is discovering this letter in which Lewis recommends Tolkien for the 1961 Nobel Prize in Literature. And that seems to me to suggest that Lewis never lost his affection and respect for Tolkien. I think the alienation was primarily on Tolkien's side.
And of course, I remember reading and hearing in other interviews that you underscored the fact that Tolkien was one of the instruments in leading Lewis back to faith. Without that, of course, Lewis may have eventually became a Christian, but he may not have written as many or as good of works without becoming a Christian at the stage in his life.
That's absolutely right. And Tolkien played a very important role. If you read Surprised by Joy, Lewis talks about Tolkien helping him over the last stile. I think actually his role was rather more than that. The letters to Arthur Greaves of October 1931 suggest a much more active and transformative role where Lewis, in effect, suddenly sees things in a quite different way. So Tolkien, I think, was a very significant figure in this respect.
Well, speaking of Lewis's conversion, one of the unique things in your book, C.S. Lewis: A Life, is the challenging of the date of Lewis's conversion to theism. While you do write an entire chapter of about 30 pages to discuss this, this is obviously not the only aspect about Lewis that you emphasize. I got a two-part question, and that is, A, do you think those especially familiar with Lewis may be too quick to dismiss your work overall about noting about the dates and why worry about them? And then B, what aspects do you believe people will miss if they dismiss reading your biography? In other words, what other unique or useful points do you make in the book?
Well, I think many readers will say, well, look, the important thing was Lewis got converted. I mean, when he got converted is just fine detail. The important thing is when he wrote Narnia, when he wrote Mere Christianity, he was a Christian. And I agree with that point. I think that there's a very big question here. How significant is a redating when it's only a matter of a year or so? So there'll be many who will say this isn't actually all that big an issue. And actually, I think they're right. But if you're a historian, I am a historian, then this actually is significant because it means that you are beginning to understand Lewis's intellectual development in a slightly different way. And that, I think, is important. So what I'm saying is, if you are really interested in Lewis's overall development, this does matter. If you're saying, hey, I want to understand Narnia, Mere Christianity better, well, no, it doesn't matter that much, and that's absolutely fair. But the point of our biography is to tell the story of somebody's life. And therefore, if you have to correct the date of a conversion, well, I think that's important.
In fact, I believe you either have said in your book or in interviews that I've seen that you didn't hunt out to look for this. It's something that naturally came out of your examination, so it would have been an injustice to really not mention it.
Well, that's right. I mean, I had no expectation of challenging anything. I sat down and I read everything Lewis wrote in chronological order of writing. And my feeling was that this will help me understand the development of Lewis's thought, it'll help me to understand the development of his style, and it might give me some nice quotes to use in the work itself. And the discovery that things didn't seem quite right in 1929, 1930, really was not something I expected at all, but I had to report it. It's there for the reader's consideration. I'm not saying I'm right. I think I'm right, but it's something I want the Lewis community to discuss. A, am I right? And then the question you asked, is it actually all that important? I think those are both very good questions to discuss.
Now, at the time of we are recording, this is actually the anniversary of when Lewis gave a talk in 1956, the literary impact of the authorized version. And one of the quotes in there says, an influence which cannot evade our conscience will not go very deep. Could you discuss for a moment here how Lewis let the Bible and his faith go beyond or around his conscience? So this influence was very deep indeed.
Well, Lewis is quite paradoxical. Lewis actually references the Bible relatively little. He talks a lot about the authorized version, but that actually is something he tends to treat as a work of English literature. What I think I see in Lewis is someone who approaches the Bible indirectly through other writers, particularly literary writers, but who doesn't really accentuate the Bible for himself. If you think, for example, of Reflections on the Psalms, one of the very few books which engages Scripture in any depth. Actually, in many ways, he's saying, look, this is quite difficult to read. Let me try and help you make some sort of sense of it. I don't see the same delight in the Bible that I see, for example, in some evangelical writers. Lewis is a very orthodox theologian. He is clearly inhabiting a world that's been deeply shaped by Scripture, but I think it's shaped indirectly. In other words, Lewis, in effect, is taking his cues from others who have read the Bible and is very happy to have his world shaped by them.
Now, another anniversary is the publication of Spirits in Bondage in 1919 during this month of March that we are recording. Could you discuss both the impact of Lewis wanting to be a poet and additionally about how he dealt with failing to become one and maybe other failures in his life that he overcame?
Well, I think you're right. Lewis wanted to be a poet. That is very, very clear. I think, in fact, he wanted to be a war poet like Siegfried Sassoon and others like him. As I read Spirits in Bondage, I have to say occasionally I find lines that really struck me as being very, very good. But overall, as poetry, they didn't really stand out. So I think I can understand those who said Lewis is a failed poet. But I think I'd want to make a very important observation, and that is that Lewis's prose is saturated with poetic rhythms. In other words, he may not have been a poet as a poet, but he's a poet as he expresses things in prose. And I think the very remarkable quality of Lewis's prose reflects his aspirations to be a poet. When I read Lewis, I very often find myself thinking two things. First of all, that's a very good point. And secondly, and it's a point that's been very well stated. But you're right, Lewis had many disappointments. And I think one of the things that he discovered is that maybe we set ourselves false goals. We think this is what we're meant to be, and then discover, no, that's not right. We have to reopen the question and navigate our way to the place we find that we are meant to be. Lewis, I think, wanted to be an atheist poet. He ended up being a Christian apologist. And I think that's a very powerful argument for the grace of God at work in the world.
Well, now, time won't obviously allow for us to go into depth about Narnia, but the month of March, again, is a anniversary for the last battle that came out in 1956. And Lewis, actually, he finished writing it exactly 3 years earlier in March of 1953. So let's talk about Narnia, but in the aspect of in what ways did these children's books, writing them, change Lewis, who was already famous from the Screwtape Letters and had been on the cover of Time magazine in the U.S. in 1947?
Well, I think that gave Lewis a new readership. There's no doubt these children's books captivated the imagination of children, but also, as I know from talking to people, the imagination of the people who read these books aloud to their children. And I think that Narnia probably is the literary creation of Lewis that is going to keep going and going and going. It's a remarkable work, both as a work of literature, but also as a work of popular theology. So I would want to say that Narnia, and I think in particular, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, is one of the standard works of Lewis. It really, I think, played a major role in bringing Lewis back to public attention after his death in the 1980s and beyond.
Now, Lewis wrote many essays on a wide range of topics. Tell us what you address in your book, and then among them, what are some essays or shorter works of Lewis that you enjoy that maybe many may not be aware of?
Well, certainly I reference many of his shorter writings in this book because they're just so good. And indeed, one of the things I felt very, very saddened about was I had to leave out so much. But the works by Lewis, the short essays which seem to me to stand out, include On the Reading of Old Books. That's a masterpiece. His essay Is Theology Poetry, with that wonderful final sentence, I believe in Christianity as I believe the sun has risen, not only because I see it, but because by it I see everything else. Or his very interesting essay, The Funeral of a Great Myth. Lewis was a master of the short essay. My favorite, though, is the 1941 work, which really took the form of university sermon, The Weight of Glory. I think that is a masterpiece. It states in a very compact form some remarkably significant theological truths. So yes, he wrote some amazing short essays, and I only wish I could engage with them in more detail.
Well, to wrap up, one of the things I didn't really emphasize is that you do a good job in balancing Lewis's warts, so to speak, as well as his accomplishments. But focusing on his successes, I want to close by noting that in trying to describe Lewis to others, I've used an illustration that he was like a top-notch baseball, football, and basketball player. He was not only a successful writer in a variety of styles or genres like, you know, children's, science fiction, fantasy, nonfiction, and the defense of the Christian faith, he was also a top scholar in his field of literary criticism. Considering this in general, then, which of these areas, if you could pick one, or you don't have to just pick one, but do you think Lewis may be remembered the most, say, 50 or 100 years from now?
I think he will be remembered as a writer of fantasy. I think Narnia is going to stay in the public imagination. But having said that, I must say he is a very good Christian apologist, and he's a very good scholar of English literature. His works on English literature are still on college reading lists 50 years after his death, precisely because they are so good. But my hunch is that the Lewis who will be remembered is the Lewis of Narnia rather than Lewis, the scholar of John Milton.
Well, Dr. McGrath, thank you for your time.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.